The question is, can we give an example of what is meant by conscious labor and intentional suffering? I said that we have to serve the future. If you take the very simplest possible example, is the relation of parents and children. When parents truly fulfill their obligations towards their children, these are conscious labor and intentional suffering. They know, unless they're complete fools, that they will have to suffer. No parent has ever not suffered. And they must accept this suffering. They must know that their relation with their children must be one of giving and not of demanding. They must know that they have to sacrifice their own self-love. They mustn't expect something in return from their children, and at the same time, they mustn't avoid the suffering that will come to them through being firm with their children. It is a very hard discipline to be a good parent. And that is a very true, characteristic example of conscious labor and intentional suffering. It requires a great deal of understanding. One can't be a good parent merely by wanting to. However much one may love one's children, one will make mistakes unless one has set oneself to understand, to be able to enter into their experience. This is why conscious labor and intentional suffering really does require a change of perception. Well, one answer is, I've just written a book about Goethe. I'd like to get my book about Goethe if I've tried to answer that question in 364 pages. But let me try and give a short answer to it. Goethe had an exceptionally difficult life. And this exceptionally difficult life was largely due to his own exceptionally difficult nature. He had a great deal to overcome in himself. He had extraordinary powers. He very seldom exercised these powers because for certain reasons he knew that he had to refrain from exercising them. I have seen him, it's quite true, I have had personal contact and I've seen it under different conditions. I've seen that he had powers that were not ordinary, not like anyone else I've personally met. He could have lived a very different life if he had chosen to make use of his powers. But on the contrary, he led throughout an extremely difficult life. He was concerned from quite an early age, from the age of about 32 onwards, 1909, in seeing how he could transmit to people what he himself had been fortunate enough to learn. And really from 1909 to 1949, that's 40 years, he labored to find ways of transmitting, constantly experimenting, sometimes failing, sometimes making quite serious mistakes, but never ceasing to search right to the end of his life for ways in which he could transmit to people the things that he had been able to learn through exceptionally fortunate circumstances. Sometimes, you have to understand that he made a distinction between intentional suffering and voluntary suffering. There is, sometimes for certain purposes, one can voluntarily, that is in effect, inflict suffering on oneself in order to gain a particular result for one's own benefit, for one's own development. Like an athlete will inflict suffering upon himself, undergoing severe training and a great deal of self-control in order to develop his powers as an athlete. That voluntary suffering is quite different from intentional suffering. Intentional suffering is accepting the consequences of one's own action for the benefit of others. Anyone who sincerely wishes to do something for the benefit of others must understand that this will always bring trouble on himself. It is a law. Gurdjieff understood this very well. He brought a great deal of trouble on himself. Intentional suffering means that one's own intention accepts the consequences of one's action. One does not wish to avoid the consequences of our own actions. Voluntary suffering is different. Here one is doing something for a definite purpose, in general for one's own benefit. As I say, the typical example of that is all the suffering that an athlete voluntarily accepts in order to become an Olympic winner. It is quite different. As far as I can see, as far as my own reading of the times goes, after 25 years since Gurdjieff died, the time has come when it will be possible, it is possible now, to put much more effectually into practice what he taught than has been over the past 24 years. That's one reason why I'm speaking as I am now. In the last 2 or 3 years, I have been making an experiment on these lines myself with the number of people at a place outside Oxford where we are, Sherborne House. I want to talk to you about that and tell you all about it, because it is an experiment following the lines of what Gurdjieff indicated in the organization of his own institute some 50-odd years ago. And it is for training people in these very things, in the development of their powers of perception, external and internal, and in showing them how it is possible to come to group consciousness. That is a big undertaking, and I can only attempt it with people who are able and prepared to devote themselves entirely to it for a long period of time, for nearly a year. I'm looking for people who have the potential for developing this, because it is very important that people who have this potential should be prepared as soon as possible, because of the increasing need there will be for people who have this capacity. And that is the task that I've set myself to do. I have been also working with a number of people in the London area and trying to show them some of these things as far as is possible without the same concentrated conditions. And I would, that if any of you people who are here are interested in learning more about this, in being able to talk more intimately with me about these very questions, about how to do things, then if you will If you will take a piece of paper that's written that is outside on the way out or sometime, and just put your name and address on it and tell us where it would be convenient for you to meet, we shall arrange it. It's not possible in this way, especially in the short time that's available, to tell you more than the sort of general principles which I've tried to give you of what Gurdjieff presents to us as the way in which the new world will come about, and also to tell you that I regard it as my duty to share with people as far as it's possible for me what I myself have learnt about that. Yes?
The chart behind you, is it exactly what it appears to be, or?
What does it appear to be? It's a way of asking the question, isn't it? I asked Gerald Wilde, and an artist who is living with us at Sherborne, who is, in my opinion, a man of extraordinary genius as an expressionist painter, to draw me something for tonight in which he would ask the question, is there life on the earth? And this is what he drew. It has to speak for itself. Yes? What happens to people who, do you say, who begin to work on themselves and then give up the struggle, did you say? I have long experience. It's more than 50 years since I first, 53 years since I first met Gurdjieff and Uspensky. And I've seen people over a great part of their lives. I have seen people who started and given up. And I've seen that it is not true that it's worse for them. I am talking now from actual experience and observation that if something has really started in people, they may give up outwardly, but something continues beneath the surface, and maybe many years later, one sees that this process has not stopped in them. I remember very well the last year of Gurdjieff's life. One man that I had known, who was actually, I believe, the first Englishman that ever met Gurdjieff in the Caucasus, just before he came to Constantinople, where I first met him in 1920. And this man, who was a very good Russian scholar, was very valuable as a translator, and he had a lot to do with Gurdjieff in the early years. And then after a certain time, he appeared to stop and drop out. And things seemed to have gone very badly with him, as you say. But he came over to Paris to see Mr. Gurdjieff. And I remember I was sitting on one side of Mr. Gurdjieff and he was sitting on the other, and he asked him, I've given up, is it too late for me to start again? And Gurdjieff said, it is never too late, and this does not stop. If you will follow my indications now, you will find what you are looking before you die. It was very unforgettable to me, because this spanned a whole lifetime. And it was like that. I have seen this more than once in my long experience, that people who have apparently given up have not really given up. If there is in the person a genuine longing for the true significance of life, they may give up for various external reasons, various personality reasons, but once the seed is sown, it does continue to mature. If their contact with it was fictitious anyhow, it's another matter. If they never did anything but pretend, then of course there's nothing, no seed has been sown. That also can happen. This is an... I am not quoting from somebody else's book. I am talking about my own personal experience. Yes, this was the subject of the very last talk I had with Gurdjieff, 1 week, just a week, almost to the hour before he died. I was with him for 2 hours that Saturday morning, and he was speaking about the conflict between the old world and the new. He spoke about this very confrontation that you're speaking about. And he said some very extraordinary things about the at that time apparently imminent open conflict that there would be in the world between the East and the West, as he put it, between the United States and Russia, in effect at that time. And he said, this looks inevitable, but it will not happen. This is not the real conflict. The real conflict is between the old world and the new. It is not between one form of materialism and another form of materialism. But this conflict between the old and the new, he said, is a serious one. The outcome is not guaranteed. It is possible for the new world to be stifled. There is an enormous inertia in this old world. In another talk I gave about this, I spoke about dinosaurs, about the passing of the dinosaurs, how when the world's climate changed, that dominant form of life gave up and was replaced by a much more active and positive form of life, the mammals, the reptiles, by the mammals. And we are at the present moment in a dinosaur civilization, great, big, slow-moving, small-brained organizations are now dominating the world. They will not give up easily, and they should not. The dinosaurs gradually lost as the climate became too inhospitable for them. They became more and more helpless. A new form of life emerged, that is, the mammals. This is extraordinarily analogous to the present situation in the world. We are at the present moment dominated by large organizations, governments, churches, industrial organizations, financial organizations. All these things are large. They grow larger. As the dinosaurs did. It is visible to everyone that their level of intelligence and their ability to look into the future is exceedingly small. They are quite unable to adapt to the new world. They are unable to adapt to the new climate. The climate for these big organizations was that of expansion. As long as there was room to expand and means to expand, that was corresponding to the to the favorable climates when we had these great reptiles. This climate is changing. We are entering a period when it will no longer be like that, when growth will be impossible, when it will be not merely a duty, but a necessity to control, to restrain. Under those circumstances, it's very strange, but it is true, that big organizations collapse. They can only exist in a state of expansion. This we can actually see. It is possible to explain just why that is so, but it is not necessary because we can see it for ourselves. What we have to look for is the much more active, mobile, and much more intelligent forms of social life. This is why we have to look to groups and communities and the emergence of group consciousness, which corresponds to the warm-blooded animals. We need a warm-blooded society, not the present cold-blooded society. Because of this, because of the great advantage that the warm blood has over the cold in times of stress, I believe that the new world will survive. I think that there will be a great time of great difficulty. And it is not possible for this, it wouldn't be desirable that the collapse of the old world should come about suddenly. It would be probably not possible to manage, but little by little it will die out, and the new form, new social forms and new modes of existence will take its place. And it's for this that we must prepare ourselves. If we have feeling towards that, if something in us responds to that, this is our first duty, is to prepare for that. Very close relationship. It's necessary to pass through certain kind of experiences together. But there is, as I've said before, there is fictitious group consciousness and there is real group consciousness. To understand the difference between these things is very important for anyone who is concerned about this. It's possible to produce, for example, an emotional excitement shared by a large number of people, a crowd consciousness. It is quite different. It is really the opposite. The crowd consciousness is really always wasteful, even if it's not destructive. A group consciousness is always preserving and concentrating. A crowd consciousness can be produced by external stimulus. A group consciousness can only be produced by an internal change. What we have at Sherborne House in Gloucester is a school modeled as far as possible on what Gurdjieff prescribed when he was laying down the organization of his own Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man, that aims at precisely that, the harmonious development of man, that is the development of all sides of our nature, not only the intellectual, but also the bodily and the emotional, and also to develop the will, which is the I, the spiritual nature of man. For this, we have very varied activities. all kinds of skills are learned. Everything is done in common. All people who are living there, and there are about 120 altogether, about 20 who are more or less permanent there, and about 100 who come for 10 months or a year, every year to work together and to go through this training. Practical skills in the house, in to take care of animals, in food production, in building and so on, all of those are learned, because the learning, the quick learning of skills, and especially when they're learned by people working together in groups, develops perceptions and develops common understanding and prepares the ground for this group consciousness. We make a great deal of use of the extraordinary discoveries of Gurdjieff of the significance of sacred dances and sacred music. That plays an important part. And we also, of course, study various psychological and philosophical and historical questions and languages, so that all, as far as possible, all sides of our nature. The people who are there range from 18 to 70 and more. There are 10 or 15 different countries. I think every continent is represented. But the majority at the present time, and have been since the beginning, have been American, from the United States, and some from Canada, some from South America also. It is possible, I don't know whether we thought of doing so, but if you were to read about it in the prospectus of the Academy, it is called the International Academy for Continuous Education, to emphasize that, first of all, its international character, and secondly, that it is for the all-round development of man, which is the notion of the Academy, and that it is for throughout life. It is not just something that one does once and for all at some age in one's life, but that this process of our development, harmonious development, must continue, as Gurdjieff states, until our last breathe. After the 13th of January next, when we celebrate Gurdjieff's birthday, and till then with the present course are all engaged in very hard work in getting everything properly grounded, after that we do have fortnightly open Saturdays and to some extent weekends also, when we are very happy to see people who are genuinely interested in what's going on. They can come down for the day, and to a much more limited extent for the weekend, because we're pretty crowded. 120, 130 people is a good number of people, even in a very big house. But we do want people to know about it and to be able to see for themselves how this experiment is going. It is to me the fulfillment of something that Gurdjieff spoke to me about in August 1923, and that's a long time ago, when he told me about a good deal about his plans and how he hoped his own institute would develop. I was particularly fortunate because it happened that I could speak Turkish as well as nearly as well as English at that time, and Gurdjieff could talk Turkish perfectly. It was the lingua franca of the part of the world, so that I was very lucky that I was able to talk more with him than most people, so that I happened to be able to hear from him a great deal about his sort of plans and ideas at that time. And those have all remained with me, and it was an extraordinary opportunity that came only about 3 years ago to be able to put a great deal of that into practice and see how it worked. And it is a remarkable thing how well he foresaw so long ago as that what could be done. He did say that this will come in the future, this will come a long time later. Yes.
Who's the architect of the Ernst Institute?
His. Of course, I always ought now to say to read my book. It's all set out in detail there. But shortly, it is that owing to an almost fatal motor accident in July 1924, when he had to abandon it, and it was when he abandoned he no longer could actively direct it himself, and he was at an enormous disadvantage, because although he spoke many Eastern languages, at that time he could hardly speak any European language and was altogether dependent upon interpreters. And in addition to being very nearly killed by this frightful accident that occurred, he just couldn't continue. Therefore, he'd abandoned all his plans for the Institute and instead put his ideas in writing, and that's how his books came to be written. Yeah?
Maybe ask how you yourself see, and in relation to the work that you're doing, and what don't you try to do, the work of people like Sharp.
Sharp is stirring people up very effectively all over the place, making them think, showing them that modes of thought that appear to be free and are really largely conditioned and so on. He is doing a very important work on a much bigger scale than anything that I'm attempting, but it is really an awakening process as I see it. We're saying this to somebody today, that I regard Shah as the Krishnamurti of Sufism, as Krishnamurti goes about breaking down people's fixed ideas and in all directions. Shah is doing a good deal to break down people's fixed ideas in many directions. And this is also a very necessary preparation for the new world. What I am trying to do is simply to take people who have enough determination and aptitude to go through a fairly rigorous training and prepare themselves to serve the world in its process of transformation. So that my task is a quite different one. Very close, very close. A very great part of Gurdjieff's message, Gurdjieff's ideas, came from Sufi sources. But I think you will see that this particular thing that I've been talking about today is not to be found in Sufi literature. I don't remember having seen it. There is another tradition alongside the Sufi tradition that is very probably more ancient, that in which this was transmitted. And it was not until Gurdjieff found that other tradition that he really saw the form in which the answer to his question, what is the sense and significance of human life, the form that answer would take. You must understand that the Sufi tradition is a broad term. If we speak about the Christian tradition, we know that we have to make a really important distinction between Eastern and Western Christianity, for example. It's not just a matter of doctrine, but a way in which the spiritual life is understood in the East and the West. There's also great differences in Islam, and particularly in Sufism, one may say that Sufism is concerned with the know-how, and the Islamic doctrine tells you what to do, but Sufism maybe is concerned with telling you how to do it. In my own personal opinion, with long years of study and having met many Sufis in many parts of the world, the central tradition of Sufism comes from Central Asia. That is the real aged, ancient source from a time that is before Islam. And this is why the true Central Asian Sufism is just as much Buddhist as it is Islamic, because that was a Buddhist country when this began. And people don't understand how important Buddhism is in Sufi, in the Central Asian Sufi tradition. This is how man is made. Man is made with this possibility. He's made us with this possibility just as much as he's made with the possibility of touching and smelling and seeing, more so, because one can be born blind, but one is not born without this possibility. It is inherent, it is in the very essence of human nature. But that doesn't mean that everyone has an equal chance of achieving it, not at all. That may vary very, very much, and does, of course. And how far people can go varies enormously. Those who were able to go all the way are the rarest of the rare. That is how it is arranged. But everyone has the potential. This is our own choice. What is said in the new law of Moses? Behold, I set before you this day life and death, blessing and cursing. Choose therefore life, that thou and thy seed may live. That challenge that is there in the new law really belongs to the time of the captivity in Babylon, when that was really understood, this. Man has this choice in front of him, and that is what is in front of us all. I must say to him, as far as I am personally concerned, my task is to find people who have a high potential and help them to realize that. That doesn't mean that there's not much to be done for everyone, but if people who have a high potential will be prepared precisely to accept the conscious labor and intentional suffering that is involved in that, they can then become the means of help to many, many other people. This is really the principle. If you're able to receive much, you're also able to give much.
What happens after the year? After the year is up.
This is now beginning to emerge. The people who came in the first year in 1971 have now been able to see what they're able to do. And I am myself very satisfied that by no means all of them could continue independently, but a certain number are able to, and are at this present time able to transmit what they have been receiving, or better to say, to share what they've been receiving with others. And this is happening in different parts of the world. That is the intention, that they should be able to do that. And also groups are forming, particularly in the United States. One in the West Coast in Northern California, another one in Massachusetts, and another one in Iowa, and one or two other places in New York, so that there is very interesting to see this. In all this, you must understand that I have been very much influenced, and even say guided, by the pattern which Gurdjieff laid down as to how he saw this developing, that he intended that people who should go through a training at his central institute should afterwards themselves be able to go to different places, particularly to their own places, and carry on what they had received. And this is happening. I was looking down with becoming modesty. Table outside is loaded with records. But a book which certainly everyone should read is Uspensky's In Search of the Miraculous. But the book, and that is outstandingly the most significant, is Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. It is much more significant in his book Meetings with Remarkable Men. It is a very specially written book. It cost him blood and tears and sweat over many years to get it written, and he has put into it all that I've been saying to you today, and very much more, but he did not intend that this book should be easily read by anyone who just happened to pick it up. To tell the truth, that to setting oneself to read Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson is itself conscious labor and intention. Not less profitable for that. I've read it, I'm sure I've read it 40 times from end to end, and I've never read it without learning something new. Every year with this course that we have at Sherborne House, we read right through it from end to end. I couldn't believe it sometimes, but I take it myself to read this, that I find such benefit for me, and I sometimes read a passage and I say, how is it that I've never seen that before? As I'm reading it aloud, I say to myself, but how is it that I've read that page 40 times and I never before saw what he was saying there? And I think that's the common experience of people who persistently studied that book over the last 30 or 40 years since he wrote it. So that if you speak about recommended reading, that is the thing that I would put first. If you want to look at it all through my eyes, then I would like you to read this book that I've just written, which on account of this, my occupation with the academy, I haven't been able to put all that I wanted to in it, but I have tried to bring out what seems to me important, and that is that one should understand that the key to the whole thing is this question of Gurdjieff's: what is the sense and significance of human life, of life on the earth and human life? And I've tried especially to bring that point out, and also to show how Gurdjieff's teaching is related to two very ancient traditions, one of the masters of wisdom in Central Asia, which had been of very special interest to me for a very long time, and the other is a special society that was founded several thousand years ago. Simply, if you are interested in knowing how I look at all this, if extending what I've said today, then I would recommend that book. But I say again that the actual source of it all is Beelzebub's tales to his grandson. Gurdjieff has put everything into that. When that book was first circulated about 40 years ago in a cyclostyled edition, Denis Sora, very extraordinary man who had seen Gurdjieff at the priory, he afterwards, and some of you may have known him, he was director of the French Institute here in London and one of the few perfectly bilingual people I've known. He wrote to me about it and said, having studied this book thoroughly, I have come to the conclusion that some of the things which are in this cannot be of terrestrial origin. Either Gurdjieff has had communication with some other level, or some special kind of revelation is involved there. That was a very intelligent and a very learned philosopher's interpretation of this book. But nobody, it is not a book that is read by orthodox philosophers. It is not an old world book. It is a closed book to people who belong to the old world. Well, now I think we've done our stint.